Introduce yourselves, please.
I'm Ed Berger, a senator of the 34th District, which is Reno and part of Kingman County.
My name is Monica Murnian. I'm a representative from the 3rd District, which is Pittsburgh.
And we have a lot to get to, but first, we're going to hear the open.
This is State House Blend. I'm Sam Zeff. We're using coffee and donuts to help us better understand the historic legislative session underway in Topeka. The issues and the people in the Kansas legislature. Here we go.
And joining Monica, Ed, and me is my KCUR colleague, Jim McLean, also managing director of the editor of the Kansas News Service. In truth, we usually do use coffee and donuts, but tonight we're using crudité and wine. I just want to get that out there right now. We're going to pick apart the speech by the governor, hear a couple of clips from Brownback. But first, I want to start with everyone's top line reaction to the speech. Representative Monica Murnian, I'm going to start with you.
My first quick reaction is, while I appreciate the thoughts that the governor shared, I didn't hear a lot of details. I was hoping to hear some more specifics of how we could make some major decisions that are impacting our communities. So looking forward to the budget tomorrow. I think that'll help articulate the strategies. But at the same time, I had hoped that we would be a little clearer on the direction at this time that he hopes to move us towards.
Yeah. Senator Berger, your top line direction.
I think that listening to the speech, we heard a lot about efficiencies and revisiting the efficiency study that was commissioned by the legislature a couple of years ago. And certainly that is something that is admirable, something that should be done. I didn't see any interest in increasing revenue at all. I didn't see an interest in revisiting the pass-through tax. And certainly when you looked at Medicaid expansion, I didn't see much interest in that as well. I did hear several new proposals and some visionary ideas, which I applaud, and it's going to be interesting to see how we can make those work.
All right, I want to get back to those, but Jim, I want to get to your top-line reaction. What was the news coming out of tonight's State of the State?
Well, Sam, I've got several bullet points here. Lack of details. Representative Murnian mentioned that. Of course, you don't usually expect that in a speech of this kind, particularly with a budget proposal coming the next day, but nevertheless, it was pretty short on detail in terms of how he plans to deal with what could be a $1 billion deficit by the end of the next fiscal year. Having said that, I was also struck by the fact that he seemed to punt, essentially, to the legislature and is leaving it up to the legislature to deal with the fiscal problems of the state, or at least that's what I heard in the speech. Also, I was somewhat surprised by his very strong opposition still to Medicaid expansion. We know that a lot of new legislators have come into the legislature supporting that proposal, even now when what's going to happen at the federal level is so much in doubt, and yet he came out very strong in saying essentially that expanding Medicaid at this point would be rather foolish. The other thing that I was struck by, Sam, last thing, was the rather tepid applause he got. Usually this is a very theatrical kind of a show, this kind of a speech in the State of the Union speech at the federal level, and both sides make a big show out of standing and applauding and so forth, and yet there was little of those theatrics tonight.
A lot of applause as he walked into the room, but those certainly tapered off as we went through the speech.
And much of the applause, Sam, was for his mention of all the new legislators.
All the new legislators, right. I want to get right to a clip of Governor Brownback. This is about 6 minutes into the speech, where he essentially said things are pretty rosy in the state of Kansas right now.
Our state has record population, record new businesses, record grain production, and record income. My fellow Kansans, it's for these reasons and more that I can report to you that the state of our state is indeed strong.
Ed Berger, what do you think about that?
Well, you argue that, certainly, the revenues being strong, but then you talk a little later on about the difficulty in the economy as far as the oil and gas industry, as well as agriculture. So even though those sectors might be really keys and pillars to the economy in Kansas, I would question whether or not the revenue coming from them is as strong as he suggested. So that's one of the issues we have as far as our revenue, and it's been cited time and again.
Monica, your thought, is it as rosy as Governor Brownback suggested?
That's not what I hear in my community and among the broad base of people that I have the honor to work with every day. The message didn't sound parallel with what I hear from multiple different sectors. I think what that statement said to me, those are just big, broad statements, and I think we're past that in Kansas. I think we are down to facts and figures and real numbers and not just broad statements. The teacher in me wants fact-finding on all of those statements, and while I'm sure there is data to back up all of those indicators, the question is, what do they all look like together? What do they, when you mix them all together and make Kansas, what does it look like?
That's a thought from the Democratic side. Ed, I want to bounce that back to you and ask, are you hearing that from your constituents around Reno County, that, you know what, it's time to come in here, fix the problems that we have, and stop throwing out platitudes and bromides?
That was the message I got time and again as I walked our district, was fix the budget. It was pure and simple. That's what they wanted to have happen. They're very uncomfortable with the pass-through tax. They wanted to make that something that went away, I think, without exception. They also saw a need for perhaps more solvency in the state, running the state like a business instead of like the federal government.
Jim?
Yes, Senator Berger, I think we should point out for our listeners that Senator Berger defeated Terry Bruce, who was the sitting majority leader of the Kansas Senate, and he won he won the primary down there in Reno County in that senatorial district. And I think that's indicative, frankly, that there were people across the state from all sides of the political spectrum who didn't like the status quo, who frankly don't think Kansas is headed in the right direction. So, Senator Berger, that's you kind of echoed that in your response. And you mentioned the pass-through tax. Again, I think we ought to expand on that a little bit. There's already been a bill introduced in the session to deal with that, and that's part of the controversial 2012 tax cuts, but it essentially exempted businesses, pass-through income from businesses. About 300,000 business owners and farmers benefited from that. What's going to happen with that bill, and will the legislature go further than that in an effort to fix the fiscal problems?
Well, I really can't predict what the legislature will do, but when you look at the pass-through, that's probably about $220 million. So that's not going to solve our budget problem. We probably need a larger tax package. We need a larger look at the tax code for the state of Kansas as we move forward. That segment is important to address, but I don't think that's the only part that needs to be addressed. We have to look at the entire code as we move to this next fiscal year.
But a quick follow-up. The governor still, he defended his tax policy in the speech.
Yes,
I don't. I still don't think he believes there need to be any changes, but most people look at that LLC exemption and think that repealing that is a done deal. Would you agree with that? That's going to happen, and the governor's going to have to decide whether he's going to veto or.
Well, I'm not sure that's a done deal or not, but and whether the governor will sign. I'm not sure about that either. Both those are questions that are out there. But I think it's a mistake on the part of the legislature if we look at just a portion of the tax code. I think we have to look at the entire tax code as we move forward. So that would be something certainly I'd be supportive of.
So I just want to clarify, it's about 330,000 LLCs, S-corps, farmers, and a handful of college coaches. Monica, I want to hear your thoughts on this as well. We keep hearing closing the LLC loophole is a done deal. One, do you think are you hearing that in your short time across the street in the State House? And two, what else do we need to do to find $1 billion over the next two fiscal years to take Kansas out of the red?
So in my whopping 30 hours across the street, I have found my office a couple times, so I wouldn't even profess to know what the mood of the group is. But I do feel very strongly a very positive movement among the group, the folks that I've been able to work with over the last couple days and since elected. As far as the issues that I heard when I was out, when we're looking at tax policy, really what we're doing is we need to look at the local taxes also. As a former mayor and city commissioner in Pittsburgh, just coming off 4 years of that and seeing what's happening in my local school district, we're just moving the issues to the local level. And we're also doing that for all of our safety net resources in our communities. So our churches and our food pantries and our nonprofits, it's just moving down. Nothing is being fixed. It's just moving it around. As far as the gap right now, I think that it's going to have to be a combination of things, but one thing I feel very, very strongly about is that it cannot be the securitization of the tobacco settlement. One-time fixes are bad to start with, but that is money that belongs to kids in Kansas.
And I want to move on to school funding formula, school finance, that after the budget, that may be one in 1A in the vexing department. The governor talked about starting from scratch, writing an entire new school funding formula, one that is outcome-based. I want to hear a clip from him right now.
The time has come to create a school finance system driven by outcomes that provide more opportunities to our students. We need predictability and sustainability for both educators and taxpayers. We need to measure success not by dollars spent, but by the achievement of our students.
We have two educators here. Monica, I'm going to start with you. You are a teacher. What do you think about this notion of an outcome-based formula, one that might reward school districts for an increased graduation rate, better ACT scores, or penalize them should they not reach those levels? Where are you on that?
Well, my first thought is, if that's the finance formula that appears to be the best, it seems like it would have come to the surface. There was another statement that the governor made talking about the zip code. Zip codes mean a lot to me because I'm in zip codes where kids don't have a lot. And schools don't have the ability to generate funds because of the property taxes. So the funding formula that we have now has two important components in it. The biggest one is equalization. And so this, the concept of outcomes, again, not horribly defined, not defined at all. Outcomes to me are when a kid in Galena has the same opportunities as a kid in Blue Valley. And so that's where I hope we can get to. And I think that school districts are very aware of the responsibility they have. They're very aware of the taxing responsibility they have, and also the fact that those are their kids. They're going to stay in their communities, and they're ready to work and help. We just need to get it done. I think there's general agreement among the education world that block grant funding was just simply a hold. It was just a hold. And if you've been in a school building lately, nothing is on hold. And if you're from where I'm from, definitely nothing is on hold. So I think that we have to get back and address it, and we cannot put this off any longer.
Ed, you were a former community college president, so you've seen a lot of Kansas kids come onto your campus. Where are you on this outcome-based formula? And if you're not behind that, what do you think we need to do?
You know, I'm not sure what the outcome-based formula would look like. It's the devil is always in the details. It's great to talk about that, and I think everybody believes in it. But how you can make that real is probably something that...
And I just want to stop you right there. So
sure.
When you say everybody, you think everybody believes in an outcome-based formula?
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe that might have been a little bit bold, but when you look when you look at outcomes, there's nobody that can argue against wanting better outcomes for the student that goes through a system. But you can do that a lot of different ways. I think you're looking at performance agreement on the part of the Unified School District that would set particular goals that they can achieve. That's an example of an outcome-based that is perhaps different than perhaps the governor's thinking of, but it certainly would be a way to have it be outcome-based and have those performance goals tied directly to the State Board of Ed, and Kansas State Department of Education, and their goals for students. So certainly there are ways to do that, and I think you just can't look at it microscopically. You've got to look at a larger picture.
What do you think about the previous formula before we went to block grant? Educators seem to embrace that. That's where they want the starting point to be. Certainly, you must have heard that from local educators as you communicated. So where are you on that?
I would agree with those educators. I think that formula was something that worked. It took into consideration the variables we've been discussing. It took into consideration the variables of zip code. It took into consideration the variables of who is in your school. And it also took into consideration looking at the schools themselves and their production. Certainly, those are the kinds of variables that formula addressed. On top of that, that formula addressed growth. And I think any formula that we develop has got to factor in growth, because if you have an increase in enrollment, you've absolutely got to have some additional compensation for that, those additional students that come through the door.
Yeah. I want to get to a major part of the speech, which was healthcare, but I do want to give Monica a quick chance to jump. I want to jump across the aisle, see what you think about what Ed said. Ed seems to be suggesting that there's a middle ground, a compromise between the old school
sure.
funding formula and finding a way to incentivize school districts with money or some other way to have an outcome-based. What do you think about that?
I think that phrase outcome-based means something different to everybody, but I agree with Ed. Nobody would disagree that making sure we're keeping track of outcomes for individual kids and individual buildings and individual districts it's a good thing. We know that. We already know that. But the question is, do we have the luxury or whatever we want to call it to start over from scratch when we've had 2 years of this block grant funding? Districts are hurting. They're hurting now. Kids are doing without. And we're making decisions based on reactive situations. And I think everybody would agree that outcomes are very proactive, and we are all for it. But as Ed said, devil's in the details.
Jim, I was a little surprised that healthcare got so much time in the governor's state of the state, something that you follow closely. You're an expert. What did you hear from the governor tonight on healthcare that stuck out to you?
I thought it was very interesting. Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier has been chairing a rural health task force for the better part of the last year. I thought it was interesting. One of the proposals coming out of that was for at least a feasibility study looking into the possible establishment of a new osteopathic medical school, which I thought was interesting, which would be privately funded. And there's kind of a wave of that happening across the country. And also the proposal for a new dental school. And, you know, I've been talking to legislators about that. I'm not sure how enthusiastic legislators are about that, because we know we have a shortage and a maldistribution of dentists in the state. So just producing more dentists, I'm not sure. There's also this issue of whether we not want to create a mid-level practitioner level to be out there in the rural areas. And I would be interested in what either Ed or Monica would have to say relative to those issues before we get to the issue of Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, Ed, let's start with you.
Well, I think the School of Dentistry is something that was proposed by a Blue Ribbon Task Force and was proposed to the Board of Regents several years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. So I think there is an interest and perhaps a need for something like that. Certainly the evidence is there. But again, when you look around to creating a school of dentistry, the cost is involved. And then it comes down to distribution of those graduates. You know, we have dentists in urban areas, but those areas in rural western Kansas are really in need of improved, expanded dental care. And I think whatever school of dentistry you have would certainly have to be something that the graduates would have to be incented somewhere or another to go to those rural areas. The School of Osteopathy, that's something that would be privately funded. And again, I think the goal that he has is getting more physicians into those rural areas of Kansas. But just producing the graduates isn't going to guarantee that you're going to have them in those areas that are most in need. They'll gravitate to those urban communities where they have more patients, have more clients, and they have more revenue.
Monica, your thought? I just want to mention here that if it improves the smile of Kansans, seems like not such a bad thing. But there is always the troubling question of money and how we're going to distribute these new dentists should it come to fruition. So what do you think on this?
So I've had the opportunity in my part of the world to work on healthcare access, whether it be dental, mental health, primary care.
You are on the board of the Safety Net Clinic there, are you not?
So for 14 years, I served on the board of our Community Health Center of Southeast Kansas, and I'm proud to say I was on the incorporation papers. Also served as interim CEO in our community, and it's all about access to me. This whole conversation is about access for everyone. And in a way, just like Ed was saying, access can be defined by geography, it can be defined by whether you got a car or not, it can be defined if you can leave your work during the day, it can be defined by whether the specialists are close to you or not. And I think we have to focus on this, you know, this idea of access, and that's why the big conversation about Medicaid expansion, because it's access for a large group of people. This is probably the part of the speech where I made the most notes while we were visiting, Because I have to say, I think we're past bashing Obamacare or Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it. I don't think it's a siren song. I know in my part of the world, the Affordable Care Act provides beautiful facilities and trained people who see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people a day, people with and without. And it's just about access. And so the Affordable Care Act, I think we're past the part of the conversation where it's just the marketplace, which is what the governor referenced. It is so much more than that. And I know that our safety net clinic and our community has greatly benefited by that. His response about the Titanic, quite honestly, so many of our people would love to see a boat. a boat would be good. Any boat.
Some sort of canoe, some sort of...
Anything is good. Moving the direction towards a dentist who can pull the tooth out of their head. It's just as simple as that.
Well, speaking of that, let's hear that part of the governor's speech where he referenced Medicaid expansion, and he said Kansas essentially was wise not to, quote-unquote, take the bait, and that proceeding toward expansion at this point wouldn't be such a good idea.
For states who took the expansion path, the reckoning could be severe. Given these facts, it'd be foolish to endorse Obamacare expansion of Medicaid now, akin to airlifting onto the Titanic.
Yeah, he left really. There was no doubt about how he feels about this. And we've had this debate in front of us for 3 years, but haven't had the debate.
Right.
And Ed and Monica, both, I want to ask you, because we followed this during the campaign. The Alliance for Healthy Kansas, the Kansas Hospital Association, several groups were out there working very hard to make sure that people who supported expansion got elected to the legislature. Now, right after the primary and leading up to the general, they said they think they now have the votes to pass expansion. And then Mr. Trump got elected president, and all bets are off all of a sudden. And Senator Berger, you were counted on by the expansion forces as now a supporter. How do you feel about it now, given all the circumstances?
Well, I think that's certainly a concern with the elimination of the Affordable Care Act, or at least proposed elimination of it. How that could impact on the expansion of CanCare, I'm not sure. But I do know that when you look at your rural hospitals, your rural hospitals are in a real, real crunch fiscally. And that expansion for our hospital in our community, about $7 million a year. The cut that came down the pipe was about $700,000. I've got another hospital in a rural part of the county that the expansion of CanCare would have meant about $450,000. And now they're having to go to a local sales tax to try to offset some of their deficits. So certainly, you know, you can look at this issue from two sides. The number one side has to be the consumer and the 150,000 people who are being denied access to CanCare. And the other half of it certainly is that hospital, especially a small rural hospital, that is really struggling to survive. And this is their services they've got to provide, but they won't be compensated. Same thing cascades down to your nursing homes as well. They're experiencing some of the same kind of crunches fiscally. So those are issues that are out there, and it's a big mystery as to how the replacement for the Affordable Care Act, what that will look like. Some have talked about a block grant. Well, if that block grant is based on what you are currently doing, I'm not sure that our block grant would be very large. So there are lots of factors out there to consider. I still think looking at expanding CanCare, I think that's still a viable option and something we just can't toss out simply because we're not sure what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act.
I want to open up the podcast now to questions from our good friends here at KHI in Topeka, right across the street from the Capitol. And while they queue up for their questions, I want to...
That's a signal
to
queue up.
They're crazy out here. Yeah.
We need more security, clearly. I want to ask both of you about something that was a big surprise for me, and that is the $15,000 bachelor degree. We didn't get a lot of details on that, but essentially what the governor is saying is that somebody in Kansas is going to be able to come up with a program where you can get a four-year bachelor degree, net, 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 as my dad used to say in business, for $15,000. And Ed, you are the expert. I'm glad you're here tonight.
I want to hear what you want to know if this is possible. Be very difficult, you know, to hit that target. Just looking at a community college education, you're probably looking, I would guess, about, well, certainly more than that if you would have 4 years of community college. So without, and that community college is being subsidized significantly by your local taxpayer. So if you pull that tax support out, and it, to me, it's a puzzle. I'm not sure you can throw a number out, $15,000. I'm not sure how you're going to arrive at that without additional state support for those universities to offset tuition increases. But it's that was kind of a surprise to me because, again, I would have to see the vehicle that was going to be used to achieve that end.
Monica, real quick.
One part that he mentioned was about teacher education. I live in that world of teacher education and lack of teachers and young people choosing not to go into the teaching profession. That was kind of brought in and taken out quite quickly. We need to face reality of why young people aren't choosing education in Kansas, and I think our universities can tell us exactly why. And I think that we have a budget problem, and we have tax problem, tax policy problem, and throwing in something like this, well, as a mother of 320-somethings, I'm all for it, does seem to be a little off of the focus where we need to be right now.
First question, introduce yourself, where you're from, and what's your question?
David Jordan, Alliance for Healthy Kansas. I'm glad, Representative Murnane, you brought up the budget issue and to piggyback on the Medicaid expansion work. It's projected that expanding CanCare could bring a $69 million benefit to the state budget. Were you surprised that this wasn't recognized and our legislators talking about how expanding CanCare can not only help address the budget problems but create jobs and stimulate the economy, which hasn't happened over the last 4 to 5 years?
It does appear that there is no mention of that or no acknowledgement of the economic development impact in our communities. I didn't hear that tonight. I didn't hear that. I heard it phrased as this is yet another thing for us to pay for. And so anybody who's worked in healthcare any amount of time knows there's lots of federal match, federal state match, and we're leaving money on the table. We are absolutely leaving money on the table. And so we never hear about that part of it, but I heard from it. I heard that from many people in my community, and especially from my hospital, from my doctors, from my dentist, all of those providers out there. They recognize we're leaving money on the table. And in their business view, that doesn't make good sense.
Jim, the second. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ed.
You know, one of the things that, as I understand it, I have not seen the study, but it's my understanding that the efficiency study that the legislature commissioned a few years ago, that was one of the recommendations, was to expand CanCare because it was an economic driver for the state of Kansas. So certainly I think that validates some of your comments, David, and some of your position, that would create more jobs, it would create more revenue for Kansas.
That's been an argument, Jim, ever since the discussion of Medicaid expansion started, that it's an economic driver. It's been unsuccessful in Kansas. For that matter, it's been unsuccessful in Missouri. Do you think that now, of all times, there's an opening to make that argument?
You're asking me to opine on this, but the Kansas Hospital Association has done numerous studies talking about the potential economic benefits of expansion. The Commonwealth Foundation recently came out with a study kind of on the opposite of that spectrum that talked about the number of jobs that would be lost if the ACA were repealed. So clearly there's an economic impact one way or the other to both the ACA and Medicaid expansion. I just think there's been nobody at the State House for the last 3 years has been receptive to those arguments. There's not been a real discussion about it. The discussion has kind of taken place in and around the State House, but not in the chamber itself. And back to both what Ed and Monica said earlier, it's hard for me to imagine, frankly, that this debate is finally going to get kicked off with such uncertainty at the federal level. On the other hand, I do sense there is a sense of urgency And frankly, that uncertainty can kind of cut both ways. There's a sense that we've waited this long, we don't know exactly what's going to happen on the federal level, and if we're going to, quote unquote, get in line, we better hurry up. Mm-hmm. So it'll be very interesting to see what will happen in the opening couple of weeks. Several members of the legislature, Susan Concannon, who's the vice chair of the Health Committee in the House, has said there will be hearings, so we need to keep an eye on that. I'm really interested in kind of a political question for both of our guests. Both, in one way or another, have talked about the need to look long-term at the state's budget. I think the term is we need a structural fix, that there's mm-hmm. something structurally wrong with the budget and the revenue apparatus, and we need to do that. But I'm curious about how the politics of that works and would like to know from your vantage point, because we know we've got about a third of the legislature is new, mm-hmm. right? You were all essentially elected, hired to, quote-unquote, fix the mess. But what does that mean in terms of the coalition? There's been a lot of speculation. The conservatives, Republicans who've been in charge of the legislature for the past couple of years are now not in control. There's new, seemingly more moderate leadership. Will there be a governing coalition that will emerge and will do the heavy lifting necessary, though it might be unpopular politically you're going to have to consider tax increases, right? I mean, how many people in the legislature are really willing to step forward and do that? And what will it look like?
Well, I'm not sure I'd see maybe an overall coalition. It might be a coalition that becomes issue-driven instead of conservative versus moderate. Mm-hmm. So I think it might depend on the issue, whether you drive a Republican moderate group to Democrats or perhaps Democrats with a very conservative block of Republicans. I think it would all depend on what the issue was, and they would line up on the issue, not necessarily on ideology.
Mm-hmm. Monica.
That's the feeling that I'm hearing over and over again. The politics of it are something that I don't even profess to understand. I kind of honestly hope I don't ever, because it is amazing the discussion among folks that say, you know, remember your decisions are impacting what's going to happen in 2 years. I got hired to do a job today. And while the decisions I make will be in for 2 years, I came up here thinking those decisions were about 2 years for the kids and families in my community, not me. I think it's pretty selfish for me to be thinking about that. That maybe isn't, you know, the most politically smart thing to do, but we're in a situation here. We don't have the luxury of thinking about ourselves. And as far as coalitions go, I've heard so many times in the last several days as I've attended different functions, there's a lot of people who don't care what party you belong to. People are more interested in what you do back home. People are interested in how you got here. You know, do you want to stay here for a long time? You know, the folks that have been reelected, I found that an interesting group of people that have been gone for a few years and are back. And so I agree with Ed. I think it's an issue deal. I also think that people are pretty genuinely agreeing. A big group of people on that this has to be comprehensive when it comes to the tax policy piece.
Well, Sam, you know, it's issue specific, and I think that's a good answer. I would agree with that. We have Bob Totten of the Kansas Contractors in the audience. He isn't going to ask the question, presumably, but I will. Let's drill down because, when I talked to Senator Denning the other day, he ticked off a list of potential tax increases, you know, a 4-cent gas tax increase, potentially a sales tax on lottery tickets for, you know, a whole list of things that might be tossed onto the table. But I'm curious, a lot has been made in recent years about, quote unquote, raiding KDOT to, you know, plug holes in the state budget. The thinking is that a gas tax is statutorily required to go to KDOT. You can't take it like you can the sales tax that has been being sent their way. What about a gas tax increase to make sure that the highway program is funded?
Well, I'm not sure. That's something I believe the Kansas Contractor Association is supportive of, expanding the gas tax and plowing that back into the Department of Transportation. Again, I'm not sure how that would look and what the numbers would be like. That's just one idea that's been thrown out. So I think before the budget is resolved, there'll be lots of ideas out there that floated and different suggestions. I think the one thing that we can all agree on is that a one-time fix is probably not advisable. A one-time fix just moves the issue down the road. It doesn't provide any systemic change, and that's a concern.
Well, Monica, highways are a big issue in your part of the state, right?
We talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
A lot. There's one that we'd like to be bigger than it is. So what I like about the Rise Up Kansas plan, which is, you know, part of what you're referring to, is, again, it's multiple parts and pieces. It's sharing the love among all different groups of people, all different types of activity. And for the problem that we have now, it's going to take that whole piece. I think sometimes people hear gas tax and pop up because, you know, quite honestly, it's something you spend every day. And but I also hear on the other side this constant concern about rating KDOT. So we are at the fork in the road where we have to say, this is important to us and we're willing to pay for it. How much it is can be worked out. But the reason I like the Rise Up Kansas plan, which includes the Contractors Association, is that somebody was brave enough, a group of people were brave enough, and road warrior enough to say, let's sit down and figure something out, to put on a piece of paper, to throw out and share with other people. And I think that takes a lot of guts. I think it is a way to get started, because we can't just start with something brand new. And so I think the gas tax will end up being a part of that. But again, we have to stay focused on the big picture.
Another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ness from Topeka, Kansas. I have a comment and then two questions.
Short comment.
And the short comment is, I really appreciate the environment that sets up the kind of dialogue that's going to help us really approach all the problems you're talking about in the state of Kansas. The question is really, as you listen to what the governor was saying about the infrastructure of the state and the agencies merging, combining as a potential strategy for creating efficiency and savings in the state of Kansas, what would you want your constituents, or what do your constituents expect of you in making those kinds of decisions? And it speaks to what you were saying about what are the priorities of the state. So I would leave that for your discussion.
Well, I think he talked about core services of the state being preserved and expanded and enhanced. But again, you know, agencies combining, efficiencies, that's always important. I don't think there's ever a time when you look at any business or any organization and say, hey, we are operating as lean and mean as we possibly can. I think there are always ways to improve, enhance, and improve efficiencies. It means merging departments or whatever. He cited several examples. I would assume that he could probably put a dollar figure to the savings that has resulted from those mergers. But certainly that's something that needs to be taken a look at.
Monica?
Nobody who's ever worked with me would say I'm against being efficient. But I think, again, you have to really determine what that is. Are we chasing efficiencies? I heard the mention of the cosmetology board and the barbershop. I didn't hear anybody complaining about that as I was knocking on doors when it was 105. What I heard people talking about were kids being protected in foster care. I heard about kids being able to eat. I heard about schools. I heard about schools and schools. So I don't think anybody will argue with efficiencies, but I think we need to be careful in who gets to define those. We had efficiency studies. We paid for them. Let's look at those recommendations and go from there.
Yeah, supposedly there are billions of dollars that could be generated from that efficiency study. And again, I'm not sure how deep they've gone into it or whether that's even real, but that was certainly what was discussed.
I was talking to Majority Leader Don Heineman the other day, and he said there was a special committee appointed last year to kind of dig into the report. And he kind of looked at me when I asked him about it the other day, and he said, you know, we dug into it. And he said a lot of what was there is not terribly viable. Not that there aren't good ideas in there, mm-hmm. but in and of itself, I mean, the notion that there are billions of dollars in savings in that report, I think he pretty much said that that's not the case. That isn't to say that there aren't viable options and that they shouldn't be looked at, but I think anybody who looks at that report and expects that to solve the problem is engaging in wishful thinking.
Well, certainly the new Speaker of the House, Ron Reichman, from Johnson County, has put a lot of eggs in those in that basket. And I'm wondering, you know, just efficiencies isn't going to find us $1 billion. I think we can agree on that, yes?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I work in a daily in an environment that interacts with multiple state agencies, and those interactions have changed so much over the last 6 years, 7 years. We used to be able at the local level, whether it be in city government or schools or in childcare, in healthcare, we used to be able to access, you know, information and best practice and from our state level government. Getting phone calls returned is difficult because, quite honestly, there's the positions have been cut in the name of efficiencies. But the question is, did the efficiencies problems just get moved down to the local level? And so I think that the billions of dollars, I just don't think they're there. People were really clear with me about the things that they wanted and needed. They were really interested in having decent roads and decent schools. They were really interested in having strong, like, retail and commercial opportunities in their community for both enjoyment and employment. And that they were told me, we're willing to pay for those. We want you to be efficient and thrifty about it, but we're willing to pay for them.
Ed, your final word. You get the final word on this.
Well, I'm not sure what the budget is going to look like that we see tomorrow, but I think it's certainly going to have to be something that not only addresses efficiencies, but they have to be efficiencies that can be demonstrated. I think the budget that we see tomorrow is going to have to be something that doesn't have a one-time fix in it. I think it's going to be something that has to recognize the strengths of Kansas and build on those strengths of Kansas, and certainly needs to take a look at the tax code and how that tax code might be tweaked to generate the kind of revenue that is needed to make the state run efficiently.
A good place to leave it. My Kansas News Service colleague, Jim McLean, your expertise, always welcome on this podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Sam.
Representative Monica Murnan, a Democrat from Pittsburgh, and Senator Ed Berger, a Republican from Hutchinson, this is where we turn the podcast over to you. And we're going to vote on our walk-off music. You both have...
This is so much pressure.
I've heard this...
I have been thinking about this since I got the email. I've brought in consultation. I missed a committee meeting because of this. I don't like this.
Well, but this is what you get for being on State House Blend and getting a mug.
Tell us about the mug.
You nominate your walk-off song.
My walk-off song?
Yeah. What is your walk-off song?
Well, I wanted it to be a surprise.
Well, you have to tell us because we're going to vote on that. Remember, we talked about that.
Fleetwood Mac, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. Oh. Because everything has to revolve around classic rock.
Ed, your song?
The Heat Is On. Definitely, The Heat Is On.
Wow. That's all right. How do you leave it to our friends here at KHI? Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. Applause. And the heat is on. I have to say, frankly, I think it's a tie, so I'm going to break that. I have declared myself a superdelegate, and we're going with the heat is on. State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp with help tonight from Mike Russo and Amy Jeffries. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on kcur.org/statehouseblendkansas. There it is right there. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Sam Zeff. My co-host Brian Ellison takes care of the Michigas over there in Missouri. He is at PTS Brian. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.
Good
try. He passed away.
The pressure's high.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Oh, God. Thank you for inviting me.